You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is time for Scald's Hall. And we are here with our special guest today, Michael Michuk. Good morning.
Morning.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Well, why don't we start off by learning a little bit about you?
Yeah, so I'm a local screenwriter. I've been doing it for about, I guess, 17 years, something like that. I think maybe the way to start is to sort of maybe talk a little bit about, like, why. I was always interested in film since I can remember. I remember going to the drive-in when I was a kid with my parents and kind of looking up and going, wow, I'd love to be somehow involved in the film business. But I wasn't ever really a technical person, you know, somebody who was very much interested in all of the technical aspect of filmmaking. So I guess really it was about storytelling at the end of the day. I knew that was sort of my way in. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of what my inspiration was, I guess, at the beginning. It goes back a long way for me, because I'm 50 now. I started really when I was around 35. It was really a kind of a third career for me. Sort of in my early 20s, I was doing something quite different. I was working for my father, who was a real estate developer. So after I graduated, I went back to university when I was in my mid-20s. After I graduated, this was sort of a career after ESL. I went to teach ESL for a while, and then the screenwriting thing was sort of, I guess a third career, basically. And I've been sort of successful doing it. I've had some stuff optioned. In fact, actually, my writing partner and I right now have something in development with a company called Cineku right now. The title of the film is called The Fall. It's sort of a dramatic thriller. And yeah, I mean, in fact, actually, for the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be doing a draft based on some of the notes that we got from the producer that we're working with. I've been doing some other things, too. I started a novel about 5 years ago, and I've been sort of diligently working away at it. I've got about 200 pages right now. I figure I'm about a third of the way through. Yeah, I mean, I've been sort of writing some short stories as well, and in a really different voice than what I'm using when I sit down to write a screenplay. Because, I mean, you know, Brian, I know that you probably know quite a bit about screenwriting, so it's a fairly mechanical genre in the sense that, you know, I don't want to try and say that there's nothing inventive or creative about it. There is, but it's a fairly restricted way of writing, especially given the commercial concerns right now. The industry is very much becoming, and has been on this trajectory now for about 20 years, it's becoming very much focused on creating genre-specific films for a very, you know, very sort of direct and focused demographic. So in a way, when you're writing screenplays, it's very hard to feel maybe the freedom that you would feel in some other genres. And because the publishing industry has changed so much in the past 10 years, when you're writing a novel, I mean, there isn't really much hope in a way, unless, of course, you're writing the next Twilight. There isn't really much hope that you're going to make a lot of money anymore, you know, as a novelist, right? So, and then as a short story writer, I think, or poetry, which is another genre which actually never has been really a vehicle to make much money, I think, in a way, it's kind of liberating for screenwriters to try their hands at other genres, because we're not really looking at it as a way to make money. We're looking at it really just a way to kind of express ourselves in ways that we don't feel that we can in screenwriting. So,
what kind of stories do you often find yourself telling when you're writing a short story or a novel as opposed to doing screenwriting?
I usually approach it not from a character perspective, but really the first sort of creative spark that I have for a screenplay is really actually genre. Like I'll think to myself, comedy. I'll think to myself, drama, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's almost like as if the form itself is what gets me focused on where I'm going to go creatively, right? But when I'm thinking about, you know, writing a short story or a poem, for example, I don't come from it from that perspective. I come from it from some kind of unconscious place in which I think the idea just arrives, you know? I don't really try to in any way, shape, or form, you know, push it in any one direction. I'll let it grow. I'll let it, you know, sort of sit. Sometimes it might take me a year or two before I'll actually sit down and write something. I've only ever written about 20 or 30 poems in my entire life, but the 20 or 30 poems I've written, I've all kept, and I work on them from time to time, and I'm proud of them. I feel good about them. Again, short stories too, same thing. I haven't written very many short stories, but the ones that I've written, I've been sort of chipping away at, and I'm actually going to read one today. I've been working on the one that I'm going to read today for about 6 years. Yeah, I mean, it's a really different process. And in some ways, ironically, more satisfying, really, you know? I mean, it's funny to say that, isn't it? Like, I mean, here I am, and I'm directing most of my efforts into screenwriting, and I mean, I'm not saying that I don't enjoy that too, but it's definitely, yeah, it's definitely a lot more a feeling of pressure, a feeling of anxiety, you know, when you're sitting down to write a screenplay, because in some ways, you know, your livelihood is sort of attached to it. So, do you know what I mean? Automatically, you know, you have a lot more anxiety about that, right? But I'm one of those people that actually, you know, the whole handwriting thing, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, because of my age, I mean, I started out, you know, handwriting everything. But over the past 20 years, I've really lost the handicraft, you know, of that, right? I don't handwrite anymore. My handwriting is terrible now. It used to be not bad, right? But now I do everything on you know, keyboarding, right? I mean, I was thinking today about sharing from my novel and my short story, but I also have some screenplays that I've written over the years that I know will never see the light of day in terms of, you know, actually being made. I mean, I have written those types of screenplays. I mean, I have written the type of screenplays that are so out there, and which I really enjoy and love, and when I do share them with people that I know, you know, those are always the screenplays that people will ask me about. You know, it's really interesting that, you know, the screenplays that I've written that have either been optioned or whatever, you know, the ones that have brought me money, those are not the ones that people, after I pitch them on the idea, those are not the ones that people ask me for. They're not the ones that people will inquire about. The ones that people will inquire about are the ones that I always preface with that remark, these will never be made. And then I pitch them the idea and they're like, oh, that's awesome. I'd love to see that, right? It's so interesting. I sometimes wonder if at the end of the day if the industry, you know, studio heads and producers, they all, obviously all of them, because they're MBA students, you know, that's where they came from, and they're all MBA guys now. They're not really coming through the old generation of producers were all film lovers on some level, right? But the guys that are running the show now are generally MBA guys, right? So they're all really focused on, you know, and they have to be at some level. They're all focused on trying to you know run their jobs like they would in, you know, making widgets or whatever, right? You know, in a way, it's funny because of the reaction I was telling you about that people have to the ideas that I see as not being very commercial. It just makes you wonder at the end of the day if studios and these producers really are really actually shooting themselves in the foot by not taking more risks than they do, right? It's like, I don't know. I mean, just sometimes I have this, and maybe it's naive, you know? I mean, maybe at the end of the day, you know, it's not really much of a sample size to say that, you know, my group of friends, you know, or my family, you know, or this, it's not really a huge sample size, Brian. I mean, I recognize that, but just sometimes, you know, like kind of in the back of my mind, I wonder, you know, I just wonder about that. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, I have something in mind. It was a group of previous guests I had on the show a few months ago. They run a web series called Standard Action, and what they do in order to get funding in order to make their show is they used a crowdfunding source called Kickstarter.com, and there are a bunch of other versions of this, and I know that several large projects have gone to crowdfunding sources on Kickstarter. Are you familiar with the Veronica Mars TV show?
No.
No.
Well, it was. I do know Kickstarter.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Veronica Mars was a show with a fair bit of popularity that ran for, I think, 2 seasons based on its episode count. And recently they ran a Kickstarter to make a movie.
Right.
They got from their fans $5 million, right, which is not a Hollywood blockbuster, but for the kind of film this was, it's a sort of a comedy, a quirky comedy that originated from being sort of a detective story. Mm. So they're not going to have to build huge, expansive sets. They can make this for that kind of money. Have you ever considered using a platform such as that and collaborating with people to try to make one of these they'll never see the light of day projects?
Yeah, actually, my writing partner and I that I'm working on this project that I was telling you about that we're doing a rewrite for right now, you know, we've talked about that in the last couple of years because we've seen that some projects have actually gotten some funding through crowdfunding, right? So, yeah, we've been talking about it. The thing is that in terms of budget, neither one of us right now seem to be able to have, or we don't really have an idea ready to go at this point that's in that sort of budget range. You know, the couple of projects that I've got myself personally that would fit that sort of wow category are really huge budget, massive projects that really, you know, it's completely unrealistic to think that they would ever get funded properly, you know, but I definitely think it's the wave of the future. I really believe that crowdfunding ultimately is going to be a legitimate way to rebuild the independent film business because, you know, the destruction of the DVD market was really the end of the independent cinema as we knew it, right? In that iteration that was existing for about 20 years, right? Like after the advent of the DVD, there was this little sort of window of which, you know, people like David Lynch, for example, were able to, like, take their titles that didn't get distribution, right? And they were able to, like, make some money through the DVD market, right? I mean, that's ultimately how Canal Plus ended up funding Mulholland Drive, right? Which is one of my favorite films. At the end of the day, they knew, I mean, the studio understood that the film was going to have an aftermarket, right? So that's why they gave him that money to finish that movie. After the end of the DVD market, you know, it was sort of like, well, everybody was sort of looking at each other, well, now what, right? And that's really, you know, technology is wonderful. I mean, I'm not a Luddite by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, the consequences of technological, you know, revolution is that sometimes, you know, especially in the creative industries, you know, we get this sort of leap. Suddenly, on the production side, we get this big democratization because the technology has suddenly made it possible for people to make a bunch of independent cinema that they weren't able to before. But then the distribution model on the other side, which was funding the independent cinema, just disappears, right? So on the one hand, it helps you. On the other hand, it kicks you in the ass, right? So yeah, I mean, I really, I think... Like you were saying, the title is Veronica Mars.
Okay. Yes, and it was a television show that ran for, I believe, 2 seasons.
Right.
And it had quite a loyal fan base, mm-hmm. and the director had always wanted to make a film version, mm-hmm. and studio said no, despite the fact it had a loyal fan base. And right. so he decided to put his money where his mouth is, so to speak, and say, you know what, I bet you this show has so many fans that they could fund the film.
Yeah.
And he asked for $2 million, which for a Kickstarter is a lot. That's a lot to ask for a Kickstarter, and he got $5 million.
Awesome. And so maybe the lesson to be learned from what you were saying is that if you could find something like Veronica Mars, which had a built-in fan base, you know, that would be the way, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than just coming up something completely on your own, which had no fan base at all. Do you know what I mean? Like, it would seem like the way to go would be to find something, a project, maybe a writer that has sort of a cult following and has a really well-established, you know, demographic. And like something really out there, right? Like something like Ian Banks. You know Ian Banks, the guy that... Not the Ian Banks that does the big budget sci-fi novels that are huge and probably would cost like $300 million to film, but the Ian Banks that does, you know, Crow Road and Song of Stone. I don't know if you know Ian Banks. Do you know Ian Banks?
I only know the other one.
Oh, you know the sci-fi
yeah, writer? Yeah, yeah.
Okay, he was the same guy, just that he uses a different spelling.
Okay.
He's actually writing in two different genres, right? The Wasp Factory was one of his earliest works. And I've often thought, you know, that it would be... he's dead now. He died just recently, actually. But your idea about Veronica, you know, your thing about the Veronica thing is now twigging in me, right? I'm thinking to myself that actually that is probably a really good idea, you know? Mm-hmm. If that worked for them, why wouldn't it work for other people, right?
And not that I'm plugging another private company, but there are other film projects on Kickstarter that had substantial contributions, and some of them were original. A lot of them were nonfiction. Mm-hmm. There were documentaries out there that got a lot of crowdfunding. I know that there was a...
Issue-based
stuff. There was one, I think the most funded one right now was about same-sex marriages. Mm-hmm. And it got a plug on Facebook from George Takei.
Of course.
But it was an original IP. It was, you know... It wasn't based on anything, and George Takei's not in it. He just plugged it on Facebook, and so it's not done by famous people.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of networking online, and then they got a lot of people to bit by bit contribute a sizable sum to make a professional grade documentary.
Mm-hmm.
There are I contributed to one actually about a fan base called Bronies, but there's six or seven professional grade documentaries that have been made out of Kickstarter over the last year, maybe two.
Yeah,
and there have been other projects, like I mentioned before, the cast of Standard Action. They're not the only web series that has been on Kickstarter. They're the only ones that have been on my show, so I know them personally.
Yeah,
but they've gotten money too, and they don't ask for or need a lot because they're shooting a web series, and so it's 1080p for the internet. It doesn't look like Avatar, but it does look good. And they're able to do this on the budgets that they ask for because it so happens the people who make it happen to have the talent you need to make a show like this. So they're actors, these people are really actors and their friends are really actors. And then the people behind the camera are really people who know how to do post and do lighting and do cinematography, if not trained, then at least experienced in doing it.
Yeah.
And because it's a labor of love, nobody's getting paid for it. Just their expenses, renting out locations and costuming, that kind of thing.
I would imagine that there must be some issues about transparency. I mean, let's just say you ran a Kickstarter campaign and you got $5 million to make your movie. I mean, I would imagine that part of the agreement that you would have to make for people to, to contribute, would be that there would be complete transparency during production so that a significant portion, or a huge portion of the $5 million would actually go towards production rather than into the pockets of the people that were actually making the movie, right? And so that's a bit of a constraint, right? If you were thinking about trying to find a way to make money doing independent cinema, then perhaps there are some constraints that would make it still... kind of iffy proposition, right?
Yeah, and here I really don't know the answer. I know on the gaming industry side, there have been a lot of video games that have been kickstarted.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what they do typically is they just keep a developer's blog. I know one of them is even making a documentary out of their making a game.
And
what they do is they say, okay, this is what we're doing this month. This is what we're doing this month. And so you can see, here we hired our art department. Here we're, here's the coding that we're doing. And so you can see...
Yeah.
You see everything that's going on, and so you see how they're spending the money that they
received. And that's a form of transparency, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of... It's not an executive producer walking in to see the dailies or someone from the studio walking in to see the dailies because there could be 80,000 people funding these things,
It's
not going to have 80,000 people sit down and watch the dailies.
No, it's true.
Yeah, it's stadium for that.
Yeah.
So typically, that's how I've seen a lot of Kickstarters do things.
Yeah.
You have to abide by the terms of service. And so if they promise something, they have to deliver it.
Yeah.
So that's typically what people have been doing that I've seen in order to keep things honest. And this is very new. Tim Schafer, who made Maniac Mansion and Grim Fandango, he's a game designer.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of launched a really big Kickstarter back last spring, and that was kind of the first one that went off the ball in terms of receiving a ton of funding. And so this is really new. And so there's not like a lot of data in on completed
on
projects.
What, yeah.
There's only been a couple that have been completed so far because, you know, making a game from scratch takes time.
Absolutely.
Even medium-sized budget games, which what these are, you know, even the ones that receive $4 million in funding, that's still a medium-budget video game nowadays. And so that's what they do.
But the, you see, but the gaming industry, basically the internet generation, who's very savvy, you know, very net savvy, they're the people that are playing the games, right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, like when you're thinking about Kickstarter as a campaign to fund the genesis of a game, I mean, you've already got the people listening in some sense, right? The thing with independent cinema, you ever see that film Donnie Darko?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so if you think about Donnie Darko, I know something about the production history of that film, and let's just use that as a model in a way. Like, if we were to do another version of Donnie Darko now, right? And let's just say it had never existed, so there was no prior audience for it, right? If you think about it, how would you actually explain the project to its target market, right? Like, I mean, in some ways, yes, young people watched that movie, but it was only after the fact. It was only actually because it never really got really big distribution. It was really the DVD market that really that movie started to kind of find its legs, right? So here's the thing, the complexity of the story, okay? How would you pitch that project on Kickstarter in such a way that it would render it understandable by the people that are the net generation, which is not maybe necessarily its natural audience in a way, right? Do you see what I'm saying? So in a sense, independent cinema is a very different animal than the gaming industry, right?
Oh, so, and I agree. You were just asking about transparency, and so I gave an example of what people did.
No, but I guess the thing is I'm finding this really interesting now because I'm personally invested in obviously the health of the independent cinema, right?
And a lot of people out there listening, I hope, are. What I would do in this situation, if I was going to try to make a version of Donnie Darko, I would try to generate hype online in sites where there were people who would like things like the comic book version of The Mask or maybe The Blair Witch Project because it was an indie film that got out there, even though it's not as nuanced, or things like maybe David Lynch's Dune, people who like that. Find out where they hang out online.
Yeah.
Generate hype in those communities about a project that's coming up that you know,
Kickstart,
that's right up
Kickstart,
your
yeah.
alley. And so, like, be involved in those communities, you know, go and post there, you know.
Yeah.
Find out people who they follow, like, you know, bug David Lynch to tweet about it.
Yeah.
You know, just as an example, I'm just using Dune off the top of my head nuanced, or people, or even if you want to like hit the really young crowd, maybe you go for the Game of Thrones fans because the Game of Thrones, well, a very different story. It's nuanced, and you know, people out there are starving for nuance,
and it has a broad demographic too.
And it's all about what they call inverting tropes, where you know the good guy dies at the end, and that kind of thing. And the point is, I would go and I would hunt down communities and prominent people within those communities who have a very big online presence.
Yeah.
George Takei is out there because you know he helped pioneer Facebook, and people like that, you know, people who make George R. R. Martin, you know, he has an online presence, and you know, get those people to mention your project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, powwow with them, give them a basic bullet point of what your project's going to be, and let them talk about it, let them hype
then
you're generating a hype within communities that'll probably like your project.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try to, like, online media sites that cover those things. There's got to, like, so I know gaming ones like GameStop and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the indie cinema version of those, there must be, like,
and
indie cinema news.
I mean, I know that there are cinephile forums.
Yeah,
you know, and
exactly.
Kind of thing,
and so that's what you do is you generate hype on sites like that.
Mm.
And then you launch your Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And link to everything, right?
Right.
And then you do regular updates as often as you can. You know, like, take a month away aside from your life to do this.
Because
you know, because, like, kickstarting something is a full-time job.
Yeah.
to do it right.
Yeah.
It, like to do it right in order to bring in enough money to make an indie film, you have to do it this way.
Yeah.
And then just like follow up, give regular updates. Who are you going to cast? Who's your crew going to be? You know, do you have anyone who's, you know, either like has some sort of like connection to something cool? Because, you know, very often film crews, like you can, like I can walk, I've been walked around and I've met people who've worked in projects I've known since I was a kid in Vancouver, you know? So, you know, like, do you have like the boom mic guy from Avatar or like something? It helps.
I agree with you. And what do you think about the idea of making the script available to people? What do you think about that?
I would talk to your lawyer.
No.
I don't know about copyright stuff.
After you've registered it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, once you've got
What do you do when you pitch a script? Typically, like, you know, I think sometimes you write pitch documents.
We write a synopsis, right? We write a one-pager, right?
Okay.
And then we write a treatment. Treatment usually is around 10 pages,
okay,
right? And it has some dialogue in it and stuff to give a flavor of what it would be like, you know? Typically people don't buy just on that. They might get interested. They might pique their interest.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to, usually before a producer will really sit down and, you know, do anything with you, they want to read the script, right?
Right.
Which makes sense, right?
Because I don't know. I'm the wrong person to say because I've never seen it done.
Yeah.
I would do it. You know, because it's a mirror of what used to be done, and we're just adapting it, right? So I would probably go exactly that route. Like, I would have the page treatment, and then I do the 10-page thing.
Yeah.
And then I try to have at least, you know, act one of the script or whatever for this Kickstarter, but, like, so you can see what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, because I know, like, actors and producers, like, even with the actors, I know sometimes it's scripts that sell a project.
Absolutely.
If it's scripts that sell the project, then yeah.
Yeah.
Just like I said, make sure that you're okay legally in order to do that, because you're putting it up not for like, you know, three producers to see, but, you know, the whole world. Make sure that you're covered that way first.
Absolutely. I mean, the way to do that, for those of you who are listening and who are maybe even thinking about some of the ideas that Brian and I are generating right now, you just need to register it by, you know, either the Writers Guild of Canada WGA West. Which is in LA. Either one is a good place to register your, you know, to make sure your copyright is enforced at some point, if it needs to be. That's really a quick way. You can even do it online actually now, right? It's sort of, I think it's $20 or something like that, right?
Well, there you go.
So it's pretty straightforward. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad that we had this. I'm glad that we had this conversation actually, because. I'm suddenly now a lot more. An hour ago, I was thinking probably not, but now I'm not so sure. I think it might actually work.
Oh, brave new world!
Yeah, exactly.
The people that are in it.
Yes.
All right. Well, why don't we get to some of the work that you brought for us?
Okay. Yeah. So basically, like I was talking, I mentioned briefly about the publishing industry is also going through a bit of a. A bit of a sea change, right? And I mean, the only people that are sort of making any money now in the publishing industry seem to be either, you know, in nonfiction or in actually creating, you know, 50 Shades of Grey or Twilight or this kind of thing, right? But if you want to write something that's more like with literary merit, right? Basically, you're kind of, unless, of course, you're a really well-established author already, like Margaret Atwood or, you know, Michael and Donna Jay or something like that, right? You're sort of, well, frankly, you're kind of hooped a little bit, right? So I was kind of thinking that in order to sort of attract attention, maybe the way to go about this would be to finish the novel and write it in such a way that it could be done as a radio play. Get a bunch of voice actors together, put them in a studio. Yeah, have the narrator doing the third-person stuff in the novel, right? And then in those sections where there's going to be back and forth for characters and stuff, you have people actually doing it like the old days, right? So essentially, I think it's kind of like a way to kind of do two things with one piece of writing. So... anyway, the thing that I'm going to read the fifth chapter from my book. And the fifth chapter from my book is called The Banker. It's about a banker. This banker is, in this chapter, he's talking, he's actually been asked to come to an impromptu closed Senate hearing. Okay? So basically, he hasn't been subpoenaed. He's been asked to come and speak to this select group of senators about the state of the banking industry.
Okay. So let's hear it.
Okay. So I'm going to... This entire chapter is the central character whose first name is Thomas. It's him speaking. And he is addressing the Senate panel. And there are going to be some questions that he will answer, which are not spoken, but which he hears. So basically, it's going to be his voice throughout the entire reading, okay?
First, I'd just like to say thanks for inviting me here today. It isn't often a banker gets such a polite request from his government, especially these days. Usually it's a subpoena. So you've been hearing a lot about quants, high-frequency trading, hedge funds, etc. And given the recent controversy over what constitutes true liquidity, I'm not surprised you're finally listening. A quant is industry speak for a quantitative analyst. Quantitative analysts are basically mathematicians and programmers who employ abstruse mathematical tools such as stochastic calculus to conceive programs which predictably model the flow variances within and between the various financial markets. These programs rapidly execute very high volume trades to take advantage of short-term opportunities measured in microseconds. Quants, and particularly the various proprietary algorithms they use, have become integral to the daily operations of an investment bank, particularly as the structuring departments for derivatives have become such big money makers and, as we've seen, unfortunately, big money losers. Now, just for the record, Phaedrus is an old school investment bank most of the time, and purposefully, we've never had much to do with the mortgage business, securitization, CDOs, etc., etc. Our core businesses are IPOs, and since deregulation in the 90s, we've branched out to include money market arbitrage, and more recently, high-frequency trading, as I was explaining above, and private hedge fund management. Now, a little background before I really commit myself here. Now, after Sarbanes-Oxley, we at Phaedrus instituted the Brewer and Nash Information Firewall to protect against conflict of interest. But, of course, the PCAOB and the SEC don't have the resources to really provide effective oversight. So while we file detailed protocols, it's still basically business as usual. In other words, our quants speak to our sales department, who speak to research, who speak to finance, etc., etc. Except now we document it all on a secure internal network. Management keeps an eye on the flow as much as that's possible, but we don't bother to submit reports. Look, when an investment bank institutes, or I should say is forced to institute, business practice auditing, reporting reforms, in a business whose sole aim is to create money by inventing and manipulating various types of markets and transactions, it's basically committing suicide. Look, we're in the information business, not the risk assessment business. Risk assessment as a business model in banking terms is for the clods in insurance or commercial banks. Instead, we at Phaedrus employ risk assessment as simply one means amongst many others for valuation. Our quants programs buy and sell ours and other people's risk, and our management team solidifies the data by gathering and sharing information with the relevant parties on the overall transaction climates and on a strictly need-to-know basis. No doubt, this must sound eerily familiar for those of you on the Intelligence Committee. Anyway, this is commonly referred to by the financial media as insider information. I'm sure you've heard of that before. But frankly, it's just standard industry practice for the best banks, or those, I should say, that survived 2008. So it's not quants or their programs, but our management team, in particular myself, that creates new business opportunities. And quants should not be shouldered with the blame for the Wild West derivatives markets. In fact, nobody should, as the volatility is a function of human nature seen through the lens of the various electronic exchanges. If there must be any apportioning of responsibility, it should really rest with myself. The machines are not to blame. However, in my defense, like the general in war, I must do what is expedient, not what is commonly perceived of as right. And quants are merely our foot soldiers, albeit at times reckless. But then we want our soldiers reckless, no? There is only so much control a financial institution can exert without stifling the creativity and drive we pay these people for. So quants are not the problem. For every conflagration they and their algorithms cause, they are putting 1,000 out. Just think of the victims of our market woes as collateral damage, as the Pentagon would say, but without the body parts. And that's about all I've got to say about that. Any questions? Yes, Senator. No, sir. I just finished saying there's no point in siphoning off more money for oversight or regulation. What America needs is to give us more discretionary powers. Somewhat analogous to the second Bush White House's emphasis on executive privilege. We need to fight with the gloves off. Everyone seems not to mind too much when we kill a bunch of Middle Eastern civilians by accident, so why all the fuss over a few trillion dollars purged here and there? No, sir, I would not characterize my attitude as flippant. You invited me here to share my expertise. I have done so. You might not like what I have to say or the manner in which I deliver the message, but that's not my concern. You should know I'm rarely so forthcoming, and be glad of it. No, madam, no need to apologize. I understand the senator from California has a particularly fickle constituency to answer to, and a sizable media profile to manage, so of course he has to appear belligerent. After all, I'm the current bogeyman of the month. Apropos, although the senator may not know it, he is a client, and it would be in his best interest to disclose that. In fact, so are you, madam. Yes, I am sure. Your government pension fund is managed by a subsidiary financial services provider wholly owned by Phaedrus. No, sir. The way to manage the situation is to forget the legislation exists. Don't suggest revisions, as that will be misinterpreted. Let things be as they are. You might want to quietly put it out that there won't be real enforcement. I can help with that. And to make sure there's no misunderstandings, I suggest we have all transcripts of these proceedings destroyed. Good. I'm glad we can agree on that. No, sir. The current market fluctuations should not be characterized as merely random. The political reason should be obvious. But the real reason, perhaps less so. How so? Perhaps the best way to describe this would be, think of me as a sorcerer. Performs a sort of rational alchemy, with the quants as my apprentices who provide the machine language architecture to transact my incantations. Remember Socrates, who felt life's great blessings often flowed from a sort of madness, a madness that came via the gods. For a rationalist of his stature, this was prima facie contradictory. But remember, in his times, spirits inhabited the countryside whom one could consult, if one had that sort of predilection, at moments when conventional forms of inquiry proved inadequate. He would often refer to what he called his daemon, spelled D-A-E-M-O-N, which he characterized as his most profound self. And he would refer to his daemon, or defer to his daemon, when the stakes were highest, prior to a battle, or as Plato wrote about in the Apology, his trial. He experienced divine inspiration as Eros, Eros in the Platonic sense, and saw it as integral to religion and art. And I would add investment banking. Yes, sir, I'm perfectly serious. Divine inspiration allied to reason and learning in the pursuit of and love for the good. Bankers must often make the counterintuitive leap. In fact, I would say this is the rule rather than the exception. Remember, capitalism is competition and therefore also partly instinctive. One loses while another wins, and the economy grows from the blood on the sand. It is from poor soil, from nothing really, as the resulting increase in monetary value is purely subjective. It's not real. In fact, there's no positive value that accrues to a dollar bill other than what the people as market believe. Like in the early Christian communities that were inspired by Jesus, the dollar exists and holds sway because people want and need to believe in it. Unfortunately for Christianity, its priests didn't understand the task at hand. The dogmatic maintenance of a past Eden against a corrupt present completely stifled progressive forces in the church, and therefore economic growth was comparatively sluggish during the Middle Ages. Bankers today, however, can't afford to advocate failure as divinely sanctioned so that the sheep can rest easy at night. We instead must dare to imagine growth and value where none existed before. And that takes courage. Because failure is not an option. Failure would be catastrophic for the economy not to grow. No? Think about it. And for growth, contrary to what you might think, investment bankers cannot be realists or cynics or pragmatists, as we are generally understood to be. We must instead be the most desperate, ardent dreamers. When you watch the market unfolding graphically in real time, roughly in sync to an algorithm, you feel the universe's pulse. And like a doctor searching for a diagnosis, you must conjure a stimulus to which the market will respond in reasonably predictable ways. This is not simply the result of research or analysis. It is also the result of a delicate symbiosis of intuition, ruthless action, and divine inspiration. And, as mentioned earlier, insider information. Excuse me? No, sir, I will not deny we are compensated handsomely, but I object to the hypocrisy inherent in the question. I know what each of you makes and what you contribute to the general good, and it is my expert opinion that the ratio is not an honorable one. I, on the other hand, sleep very well at night. I employ approximately 9,000 people directly, many, many more indirectly, and their incomes are generally much higher than the average Americans. I pay personally an income tax more than your combined salaries per year, although if I wanted to, I could pay nothing. The supposedly progressive tax code in America is a bad joke, in case you didn't know. Yes, sir, my father was Robert Overman. Yes, madam, that Robert Overman. Could you enlighten me as to how that is pertinent? Oh, of course, yes. I'm glad you're aware of it. His contributions to econometrics were fundamental. Not many people remember him for that now. No, sir. His disappearance was not a tragedy. He lived a great life, and although I was too young to know him well, from what I understand, he loved his work. He spent most of his professional life in the Middle East.
And the governments he worked for benefited enormously.
And often in ways that are hard to quantify. He was a great man. Yes, sir, madam, likewise. And thank you all again for the invitation. I trust we all have an understanding.
Yes?
Excellent. Then let us hope we can work more closely together in the future and in a more collegial manner. I am not the enemy. In a sense, we are in the same business. So try and think of us as a sort of Socrates, economic gadflies, agents of destruction and creation whom society needs and therefore inevitably resents. Thus, we are a lonely species. Take care that we flourish, for with us lies the future. The story I'm going to read tonight is part fable, part parable. It's kind of a throwback, really, right? It's not really in any way, shape, or form postmodernist or post-postmodernist, whatever period of literary history that we're in. I don't keep much track, actually, of what's happening on that front. I guess the reason that I wanted to write this story was that I guess I'd been at the time, yeah, it's about 6-7 years ago, I had just sort of come through a separation and divorce, and it was a particularly hard time in my life, and I was looking for a way to, I guess, to come to terms with what had happened and my feelings about it. So in a way, the story is kind of semi-autobiographical. I think also I've been reading a lot of romantic poetry, and I mean romantic in the sense of the literary sense of that. I don't mean as in Harlequin romances. I mean it in the sense of Goethe and Shelley and Coleridge and a little known German poet and theorist by the name of Hölderlin. I don't know if anyone out there has ever heard of Hölderlin, but or I should say his proper pronunciation is Hölderlin. Anyway, a great poet, and one that wrote in terms of style, anyway, very much like a kind of an alternate universe, very much like Coleridge, right? And really ecstatic type of poetry, right? Where, all of the characters and all of the situations are somehow archetypal and mythic, eh? Yeah, there's this real mythic quality to them. You know, a lot of what we do nowadays seems to me to be so, drenched in irony that it's almost as if, we've reached a point in our culture's development where we just can't really actually confront real and genuine emotion and spiritual concerns without feeling awkward. You know, it's like as if, you know, we live in a time now where we just can't actually be earnest about anything anymore. And I guess from my point of view anyway, that's basically, you know, why art, and I mean that in a sort of a general way, you know, rather than just literature, I mean. I just sort of feel that, yeah, we've reached a point in which there just really isn't anything particularly inspiring. You know, it's very rare now to go and see a movie or read a book or watch a play or, you know, go to an exhibition, you know, at a museum or watch a new composer's latest work and feel, you know, that sort of wonderful sense of encountering something that's really going to give you the out of body experience, you know, to use Aristotle's terminology, the cathartic moment, right, where, you know, life suddenly, you see your life and life in general as magnificent or in some ways profound and sublime, you know. And I guess that's basically where I was coming from for this. So anyway, I hope you enjoy it. A Boy by Michael Mityuk. Once upon a time, a boy was born to parents who didn't much care for him. He was a special boy, not because his parents didn't care for him, as we all know that is commonplace, but because he didn't need for them to care. Of course, he didn't know that at the time. Indeed, he often felt heartbroken by it at first. But eventually, it became clear to him that he could be quite happy on his own. You see, luckily for him, he lived on the outskirts of a town next to a vast wilderness. He could walk out his back door and in 10 minutes find himself in the middle of nowhere. And that's where the gods first found him, wandering aimlessly amidst them. They took an instant liking to him, as he was perfect in every way, like many boys are in the beginning. Naturally, he didn't call the gods by name, nor did they use his, as we humans do, as if we really knew each other. Indeed, the boy was better acquainted with them than he ever was with humans. They would often rescue him from the shouting and violence of the humans. Safe and well in their bosom, he would ask of them secrets, and they would share the ones they thought he was ready for. He became particularly delighted with the so-called simple things in life that are anything but simple. The haphazard harmony of wildflowers dancing in a gentle breeze, the poised, majestic march of the constellations across the night sky, the gentle, pristine promise latent in a kiss of dawn's dew. So hopefully you can see now how this boy could be happy in his own way, despite being cursed with such parents. Indeed, in many ways, it was not a curse, but one of those mysterious blessings in disguise you read about but never actually experience yourself. And though you might find him strange, he felt his strangeness was really not such a bad thing. One day, years after he'd become a man, he was sitting in a little café in Paris on the Rue de Bac, nearer to the Quai Voltaire than the Jardin du Luxembourg, when the most extraordinary girl in the world sat down at the table next to him. She was young and beautiful as when the world was young and beautiful. Sitting next to her, he felt young and beautiful again, like he felt on the inside still. So he struck up a conversation with her, because it seemed like she too had time on her hands, and also because he had so much now, he felt he could lend her some in case she needed it. At first, she had a hard time understanding him. He spoke very crudely, although his French was perfect, as if he didn't really understand how he should be talking to a beautiful girl half, or even less than half, his age. But quickly she realized that was just natural to him. So she relaxed, and soon she found herself feeling intrigued by his simplicity. There was something almost ecstatic about him, like he was in love. For his part, he realized she had been nowhere and seen nothing really yet, other than Paris and Bergerac, where her family had a summer cottage. At first, she spoke about her life in the way that young people do, with a mixture of affected boredom and repressed desire, but that was only because she thought she had to. Eventually, she began to share her real self with him, and that was when he realized he was speaking to a girl like he was a boy. So he told her the truth, that he had never loved anyone, that he had never needed to, that he could never love anyone really in the way humans do. After he made these startling confessions, she thought he was teasing her. But she soon perceived he was serious, although it seemed improbable to her that such a man could possibly believe that when it was obvious to her he was in love. And then it came to her, and it made her shiver. Maybe he was in love with someone and didn't know it, which, for someone like her, was the very height and brink of romance. So she did what comes naturally to most girls. She fell in love with him, as hard and as fast as young people who don't know any better have always done, and hopefully will continue to do. Many years later, when he was an old man, he was walking in the forest adjacent to his hometown when he came upon the god of the river. He said hello, as they hadn't seen each other for some time, and the god invited him to sit down on the riverbank for a chat. They reminisced about the good old days, as old people like to do, and later laughed politely at each other's charming stories of far-off places and events, as each of them had been everywhere and done everything. But when the river god asked about his girl, the once-upon-a-time boy, who was now an old man, fell silent. What could he say after all? The gods didn't really know anything about love, really. How could they? They were just gods. You see, he had come to realize they could adore him when he had been only theirs, but they had never actually loved him in the way his girl had loved him, in the way he had learned too late to love her. How could he share with a god the tragedy he had made of her? The god would only see the big picture. What did it matter anyway, the god would think, because it had all been merely temporary. So he decided to change the subject, and soon their conversation came to an end, as effortlessly and naturally as all conversations should. That was one thing he really appreciated about gods. They had better things to do, and therefore never imposed themselves. Later that afternoon, he went to visit his parents' graves. He hadn't been there for years. In fact, he couldn't remember the last time. Indeed, perhaps he'd never gone and had just forgotten, like so many things. As he stood there looking down on his parents' tombstones, he realized there would be nobody to look down on his. The gods would not come to visit, as they were not sentimental. And although the plants and animals would, they would not be sentimental either. The weeds would grow and the insects would eat him, and the birds would defecate on his tombstone, and that would be about it. But he felt that all was as it should be, though you might not believe it. Because he had loved once, truly, there was nothing left to do. Yes, he had never told his girl in time that he loved her. But his regret, so keen, so sharp, blazing amidst everything else that had become so dim in him, would be the great crystalline wheel that his soul would be stretched out on, taut and quivering as it spun through the dark, enormous sleep to come.
Thanks, Michael. Coming up next is Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam, so stay tuned here at CITR 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.